today. As the former Downing Street press secretary, Alistair Campbell, writes about a lifetime struggling with depression, we speak to him along with his partner Fiona Miller and daughter Grace. Can you just describe how bad it got?
Well, it was a full sort of psychotic meltdown.
Alistair Campbell is describing something that happened to him in the spring of 1986 when he was working as a journalist.
I'd been working very hard, I'd been drinking a lot. Fiona and I had sort of fallen out quite badly.
Fiona was Fiona Miller, his partner.
And I was on the road with Neil Kinnock, who was then leader of the Labour Party, who was up at the Scottish Labour Party conference. I'd had a very, very, very heavy night the night before. I actually had woke up in a hotel. I hadn't changed, I hadn't gone to bed. I'd drunk the minibar dry. I got in a cab to Heathrow to meet up with Neil and his party to fly up to Scotland. And I went and bought a new suit and shirt and tie, and I got changed and sort of cleaned myself up. And then as the day wore on, I just started to feel really, 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 really strange. And then by the end of the day, I was hearing voices. I was in this council building in Hamilton, and it was just a crack up. It was like a complete psychotic meltdown. My brain exploded. And eventually these two policemen came and started talking to me, and one of them asked me if I was okay. I said I wasn't, which was a big step forward, actually, because it's the first time I'd admitted I had a problem. And anyway, I got arrested for my own safety, and I got taken to the police station, and then a few hours later a doctor came, and then I was taken to hospital.
Fiona, when you found out about that, how did it feel? Was it one of the first times you realised the extent of Alistair's mental illness?
He'd moved into this hotel, you see. It had got too much for me, and I really was really worried about what was going on with him. Although I didn't really realise it was a breakdown, but his drinking was becoming overbearing. And so he'd disappeared, gone to Scotland. And the first thing I heard about it was a colleague of his in Scotland phoned me about 1 a.m. and said, I don't want to alarm you, but Alistair's been arrested in Scotland. And I immediately realised that it was something psychological. So I just got on a plane with my dad, actually. We ended up back in Paisley, where he came from, which was really strange, with Alistair in this hospital bed, completely sort of comatose and dead to the world, really. It was very, very shocking. I mean, I was only, you know, 27 or something at the time, and nobody really talked about mental health back then, so I had no comprehension at all about what a nervous breakdown even meant, even though I knew something was wrong before it happened.
34 years after that rock-bottom incident in Scotland, Alistair and Fiona are still together with 3 children. He's best known as Tony Blair's former spin doctor. It was a role that brought head-spinning highs, driving Labour into power in 1997 and enacting sweeping reforms to health and education, as well as controversial lows, with Campbell's role in the Iraq War turning him into a hate figure for some and even prompting tension at home. Since leaving government, he's worked as a campaigner, strategist and writer. Throughout it all, before the high-intensity, high-stress roles, during them and afterwards, one thing remained unchanged. The torment of depression. We spoke to Alistair, Fiona and their daughter Grace together to understand how a lifetime of mental illness doesn't only impact on the individual, but on all of those around them. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, Alistair Campbell and his family on living with depression. You obviously had a long and successful career as a journalist. You were political editor of The Mirror and The Sunday Mirror. You talk in the book about obviously the breakdown and continuing to have depressive bouts, but essentially being stable for over a decade before Tony Blair approaches you about working for him. And I kind of love this story that you tell about how he turned up on your holiday in the south of France, and you describe one room with him and Cherie trying to persuade you to take the job, and another with Fiona and Neil Kinnock, who you're away with, persuading you not to. Can you tell us about that?
It was a bit of a holiday from hell, that. It really was. Tony asked me the day before we went away. I did actually say no in the first instance, but I don't think I meant it. And I think he knew I didn't mean it. Once he knew that Neil and Glenys were with us as well, I think he got an instinct that everybody would be ganging up on me and trying to talk me out of doing it. And so he just phoned up one day and said, you know, we're only about 4 hours away. We're coming over to see you tomorrow. We'll come over for lunch. So he arrived with him, Cherie, the three children, and his mother-in-law.
And all the food from the fridge at their last
and
house.
And they'd been rented a house, and they filled this bag full of all the food they had in the previous house. And, yeah, he got the sense that I was maybe thinking of not doing it, and he'd come all that way to make sure I didn't. It was very, very tense. And I remember when, I think Fiona knew I was going to do it anyway, but I think when I told her, my mind was made up. It was a difficult moment.
Why, Fiona, were you against it?
Well, at first, I should say my father had just died and I just had a baby. So I was quite emotionally a bit damaged myself and finding life a bit of a struggle. And apart from that, I did feel that we'd got our life to quite a good place professionally. We both had good career life balance. We had a very nice big new house we bought and got this new baby. And it all seemed like, why upset all this peace and calm and happiness? I know it was a very important thing for Labour to win, and I do appreciate that. And I've been a member of the Labour Party a lot longer than Alistair, so it was in my blood. But at that stage, I could sense it was going to bring a lot of disruption and possibly a lot of pain into our lives. And, you know,
well, it did.
The rest is history.
Did it?
Yeah, it did, but I'm still glad that I did it.
No, I think it brought some amazing high points and fantastic opportunities. But there's no doubt that with a young family, it was tough.
And were you worried about Alistair's mental health?
I was.
A bit, yeah. But I mean, I just knew it was going to be like something none of us ever known before. Until you worked in Number 10, you really can't describe the sort of level of pressure that exists on a daily basis. And remember, we were both working there.
What were your worries about that job, Alistair?
I think I was partly worried about having cracked up before. I just thought, you know. And I was also worried about the thing with Fiona, because I know what I'm like. I know that when I get on a mission, I just go for it. And I knew that could be a big risk. But yeah, I was worried about the pressure. I was worried about the profile that I knew would come with it. I was worried about friendships that I knew would probably go on the back of it. But Tony was very persuasive, I have to say that. He knew how to reel me in.
He said, together, we could change the face of British politics for a generation.
How was it for your mental health? How was your depression during that period, and what was the job like?
Well, the job was full on, and I think it'd be full on whoever did it, but it was very full on the way that I did it, because that's the only way I know how to do it.
He was branded by some as the second most powerful man in Britain and the nation's unofficial deputy prime minister. Exaggerations perhaps, but Alistair Campbell was certainly much more than just Tony Blair's media advisor.
And I think it was, on balance, probably bad for my mental health. And it's interesting, when I go through my diaries, I just couldn't get over how often my entry day, they would start, woke up feeling shit, and it would end, went to bed feeling shit. And that's really, it was me just reflecting the fact I was fighting through it a lot of the time.
I think the work was a form of self-medication as well. I mean, I think you just work to push out all these other feelings that were sort of flooding into you.
Mm.
I think it held the whole thing at bay. It was only after we stopped completely in 2003 that the sky fell in again and we started to realise that, you know, there was a serious problem with Alistair's mental health and he would need to seek some professional help.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you about that. Just before I do, Grace, do you have a memory of that period?
I was 9 when Dad's mental health got really bad after he left Downing Street. And I think that would happen to anyone. I think after you leave that job, you would be bound to crash. But that was the first time in my lifetime, because he started that job when I was a baby. And so I saw him fleetingly. And when I did, he wasn't in big bouts of depression. When he was suddenly back home, he was also suddenly very depressed, not like the person that I was used to. And that definitely formed lots of my anxieties around my parents dying, because it was sort of a crazy thing to suddenly see him so vulnerable.
Why do you think that there was such a long depressive period after finishing the job?
I don't know.
When you worked there, you were forced to think about all these other things. It was a just non-stop round of high-pressure meetings, decisions. And once that all stopped, it was like, I think you were left with what was underneath, which was your
mental
health.
Yeah, but I think also it was a physical mental decompression as well. I think my brain just was getting used to being under less pressure. But it was a bad one. It's no doubt it was a really, really bad one. I write in the book about this explosion that I had on Hampstead Heath, and that was the day when I knew in myself, I've got to stop pretending I can deal with this on my own. I've got to get somebody else to help, because Fiona can't do it, I can't do it, I can't put it on the kids. I've got to go and find the right person for me, and luckily enough, I did that.
What did you do on Hampstead Heath?
I started beating myself up physically, and I think it's a form of self-harm. I was just like, I couldn't get over how I was feeling so bad inside. And Fiona and I were arguing all the time and we'd gone out for a walk to try and sort of clear the air a bit. And I literally started punching myself in the face.
Fiona, how did you feel about what happened on the Heath?
Well, I was scared. I was very scared. And in fact, I think it was the trigger for Alistair to start seeing somebody, which he hadn't done since 1986 when he had that meltdown in Scotland. It's really a long time, if you think about it, not to, you know, to
20
be
years.
20 years to be mentally unwell and not to be having any expert professional help.
Imagine if you'd had any single physical ailment that serious. Imagine not seeing a doctor for 20 years about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's just bizarre, isn't it? But, you know, better late than never. And it's interesting, I've been contacted by people already about the media around this book. People are in the same situation saying, you know, I just, if only I could persuade my partner to see somebody. That is so critical if you can do that, you know, try and access some sort of help and support because it will make a difference. But I think, you know, a lot of people in Alistair's situation feel they want to cure themselves. He wanted to cure himself. But sometimes that's not possible.
Can you describe what depression feels like?
The best description I can give is it's like being dead and alive at the same time. You feel alive because you're breathing and because you're conscious of things around you, but inside you feel dead.
You've described seeing the depression in an almost physical way, a kind of vision looming above you. Tell me what it looks like.
It's like this thing, like a jelly. It's got a sort of light beigey colour, and it's the shape of a rugby ball. It's about five times the size of a rugby ball, and it's just like a cloud that's hovering above me. And then I sometimes try and talk to it, tell it to F off, and I tell it to leave me alone, and then eventually it just comes closer and closer and closer, and then it gets into me. It's almost like being injected. You know, if you've ever had a general anaesthetic, that feeling with the last few seconds of the general anaesthetic. And obviously I don't go under, but it's like you're giving in to this thing that takes you over. People talk about suddenly their veins feel like lead, like you've got metal being poured into your veins. That's what it feels like. So you feel very heavy.
And when you're lying there like that, Fiona, how do you see it? Have you seen a situation where that cloud is above Alistair? And what does it look like to you?
I would say that that sense of being with somebody who was sort of like comatose, dead eyes, dead to the world, it's a quite a physical manifestation of the depression, yes. That's not the only manifestation, I have to say, but it is one of them.
I think we'll come to some of the others. Alistair, what are your earliest memories of feeling like that?
Those feelings of absolute dead inside, I don't think I've really known them until I started to think about what they were, because for a long time I drank when I was beginning to feel like that. And other times I would maybe just throw myself into work or whatever. But it's since I've started to think about what the feelings are that I've become more conscious of that sense of being dead inside.
You talk about thinking about your funeral, and you talk about the idea that Fiona and Grace and the others would get over it, that they'd be sad for a while, but that they'd get over it, and that sometimes you think, and then it would be better for them. And I think in that section, you even describe something about who might give you a eulogy, and you sort of landed on Tony Blair. These aren't the sort of thoughts that most of us have, are they? Was that something that dominated much of your life?
Thinking about death?
Yeah.
You say that most people don't think like that. I think people do think about their own deaths quite a lot. And I've also written that chapter in the book about my cousin who did kill himself. And that had quite a profound effect on me, I think, in terms of thinking about, you know, the finality of that. When I'm doing that suicidal ideation, being dead, I don't feel sad. It's really strange. I feel almost like I'm thinking through something in a kind of logical way.
I think there is a thing you've got. The thing about depression is, you know, people do overthink things and they think about all the worst possibilities of what might happen. It's just part of that, more so than the rest of us would do. So in a way, it feels to me quite natural that you'd think through all the most gloomy outcomes that could possibly happen of any situation. I think when you were working in politics, that's how you thought as well. You were constantly thinking
everything was
going
to go wrong. How did I stop it?
Yeah, and that, in a way, that's what made you very successful.
But the thing about suicide, it's like, well, I get so angry when people say, if somebody's killed themselves, and they say, God, it's the most selfish thing you could do that and leave your children behind and all that. I am absolutely convinced, I don't know this because I don't know what was going through his mind at the time, but I am pretty sure, because he was a very similar character to me, that my cousin Lackey, who had three children, I am pretty sure that when he killed himself, he thought he was making life better for them and his wife. I'm convinced of that because I think he thought he was taking the pain out of their lives that he was giving them. I don't think I'll ever kill myself, but I know that whenever I've got close, a part of my thinking has been, I've put them through enough.
And you have got close.
Yeah, I've got close in that feeling of that I can't bear this pain. I want it to end. And that will be better for them. I've got very close to that, yeah.
You've spoken about waking up each morning and giving your state of mind a scale from 1 to 10.
Hmm.
Tell me about that.
Well, 1 is delirious. 1 is like, I can walk on water, I can stop Brexit, Donald Trump doesn't exist, and it's like everything's perfect, and therefore it's unattainable. 2 is manic, but manageable. 3 and 4 are where I like to be, full of energy, positive, quite happy most of the time, and life's good. 5 is kind of stable. 6 and 7 and 8 is when I'm on the kind of downhill slalom into a really bad depression. 9 is when I can't get out of bed. And 10 is what my cousin had when he killed himself. So that's my scale. And I measure that every morning in my head. And if I'm between 3 and 5, I think the day is going to be okay.
Is it hard, Grace, to know that your dad is so often in such a bad state mentally?
I do think you do have loads of times when you are just generally quite happy and content. It's not like my dad's mum was always sort of happy and content. Mm. That was her everyday level. You do achieve that.
Yeah.
In moments, and that's very nice to be around. But I think we just are very used to going along the ride with you.
You forget one very important fact, that one of Alistair's least favourite words is content. He thinks contentment is a terrible state of mind to be in. Being content means you're not doing anything, you're not agonising over anything, you're not fighting anything. So you don't want to be content, do you?
Look, I like being in a good mood. I like feeling good. But I do feel, and Grace is right, my mum was one of the happiest people anybody could ever have met. She was incredibly positive. And she would always say to me, when I'd be kind of agonising about something, she'd just say, why can't you just be content? And content to me did sort of say complacent. You know, don't try and change the world. Don't try and fight.
Alistair, you talk about how being open about mental health makes you realise that everyone has a story. And I know that those of us listening to your conversation also have stories. Mm. I lost a loved one who had terrible bipolar. And one of the things that struck me, and I want to ask Fiona and Grace about this, and breaks my heart when I think back to it, that I even had these thoughts, is that sometimes it's incredibly hard to like someone and to feel that you can continue to support them when they're in the midst of mental illness. Mm. Did you ever feel like that?
Me? Yeah. I mean, it is really difficult. It's really difficult. I felt to blame a lot of the time. So I felt upset with myself and angry with him. Yeah, it's really, really hard. And I can understand why some people walk away from those relationships. I do understand it, because it has an effect on your mental health as well. So it's not healthy on a number of levels.
Why didn't you walk away?
I mean, obviously I loved Alistair and I wanted the family to stay together. You know, my parents had long marriage until my dad died. I wanted to kind of replicate that. Loyalty. I think there's probably a part of me that thinks I can save people. A bit more effort, you know, I can make them better. But I felt it was very important not to let the thing fall apart, definitely. Definitely.
The focus is always on the person who's ill, who's got the condition. But actually, the impact of one person's mental illness, you know, there are ripples around into your friends, your family, relationships. And I do think that there's not enough understanding of what it's like for those people who are living with people who are mentally ill.
I think it's taught us all a lot about empathy, and that you never really know what people are going through while you're with them in that moment. They might seem fine, but they might not be fine. And I think you have to always give people benefit of the doubt. You know, if they're being a twat, you don't know what's actually going on in their head or in their life. So that's definitely something that I took with me to secondary school. And I used to always think that a lot. You just never know what people have going on in their heads.
I wouldn't want to be with me when I'm depressed. I really wouldn't. And quite often, in my defence, I will vacate sometimes. I'll just disappear.
Yeah, but you vacate, but it's still in our minds. You know? I know you're depressed. It doesn't matter where you are. If you're on the other side of the world, I'll still be worried about you. Mm. But it's easier to know you're safely close at hand, not thinking bad thoughts.
Mm.
I also think it's very lucky that you don't have any sort of similar situations yourself. I do think it's difficult in relationships where both people are struggling in that level of intensity, because it's very hard to help the other person when you need there to be loads of space for you. And I think what's amazing about you and why I say Dad is very lucky is because you are good at creating space for other people because you're sort of generally level-headed.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I can honestly say I've had days when I feel down and not happy or pissed off with things, but I just do not understand what it must feel like to be chronically depressed. I don't understand it. So maybe that's the secret in a way, is that I'm not suffering. You know, I am generally a contented person. Oh, that awful word. My life must be terrible. I'm contented, you know. But I mean, I'd say I'm between a sort of 5 and a 1 most of the time.
What about you, Grace?
I mean, I relate to a lot of what Dad's saying. I struggle with people that I'm in relationships with because I feel incredibly guilty that I'm putting a lot of my stress onto them. And it is really hard when you're in the moment. You're not trying to be selfish, but you just can't really see a way out other than to like attack other people because your mind is just attacking every element of your life. It brings out all of the worst thoughts in your head. And I just think it's incredibly difficult to be with people in those situations. And me and Dad do exactly the same thing, where anything anyone will say, it's not the right thing that we want to hear in the moment. And it can be impossible to help. So, I mean, yeah, I just need to find a male version of my mum.
Alistair, you talked about seeing a psychiatrist as a turning point for you with depression. What did seeking help do? How did it help?
Well, I've had a very good experience with a psychiatrist back in the 80s, the guy in Paisley in the hospital. He was terrific. Then I had some bad relationships with psychiatrists, and that may have been another reason why I sort of pushed it away. But I think in the end, it's like personal relationships. It was Philip Gould who knew this guy, who said he thought I'd get on with him, and I did. So the introduction was good. I liked him from the first time that I met him, and I trusted him straight away. Because of this incident on the Heath and because of this long period of depression that I'd had, I just knew that I needed something, and I think I decided to put my faith in him and put my trust in him. And then I record a lot of the stuff in the book that we did together. Some of it I found a bit weird at times, you know, all the dream analysis and all that sort of stuff, but even that I found I got something out of it. And then all these very practical things that we did, and these exercises that he made me do. And I just got to a better place. And then he was also the guy, I guess, who persuaded me that there's nothing wrong with medication if it helps you. I'd always resisted medication. He's persuaded me that that's a kind of pretty stupid way to think. If you've got medication there that can help you, take it.
Coming up, what entering lockdown meant for Alistair's depression. Can I ask you about this most recent period? In many ways, it feels as if COVID has made us all think harder about mental illness. I mean, you can see it in the figures. Levels of stress, anxiety and depression have been high, especially if you've got a mental health diagnosis. I mean, we've spoken to our colleague John Crace about that. This has been an immensely difficult period for him. Tell me what it's been like for you.
Well, I've got to say, John Crace has made it a lot better than it otherwise would have been, because he's one of the few things that keeps me going when I... His political analysis is often on the money. Well, I've had a very up and down lockdown. The start of it, I loved it in a bizarre sort of way.
You got into nature.
I did. I got into the nature thing. I know a lot of other people did that.
Walking on Hampstead Heath every
day. The tree of the day and all that. I was also keeping very busy. I was writing a lot. I was finishing a book. And then I had a minor dip. Then I went into a really bad manic phase, which was bad, wasn't it? Which went on for quite a while. And then after that, and this always happens, at the end of that, I completely crashed. And it was a bad one and it was a long one. And then we went away on holiday and it was fine. So very up and down, to be honest.
When you do feel a dip approaching, do you have a checklist of things you can do to help?
If I feel a plunge coming on, I might just say, right, I'm going to go and do something very nice for Fiona or for one of the kids. I will do some work which will make me some money, and I will do some work which will not make me money. And that's my sort of meaningful activity bit. I will then make sure I sleep, make sure I eat well, don't eat sweets. No matter how low I feel, I will force myself to do exercise. That really helps. And then the checklist for me would include, I will play my bagpipes. I will do something related to Burnley Football Club. I will listen to Motown. I will read. I will do something in one of my foreign languages. And then I'll take my pills.
I knew she was exhausted now.
Sorry.
Most normal people will not do all that.
That's like my life checklist. Maybe one day.
No, it didn't take that long.
Part of what you've talked about in this sense of mania is writing nonstop, tweeting ideas that you think are brilliant in the moment and perhaps don't seem so much later.
What, my three Olympics?
How do you reflect on those periods of mania?
This one I knew was coming to an end, and I knew when it ended was when I did this daft thing. I was rewriting the lyrics of all the national anthems, like you do. And I did God Save the Queen as Boris Johnson singing about changing the lyrics. It was about how much he loves Dominic Cummings. And it was actually, they were quite good lyrics, I've got to say. They were funny. Fiona's got this picture in her office of the Queen with all the serving prime ministers who were still alive, which is a dinner that we organised in number 10. So I stood in front of that wearing a suit, my brother's Scots Guards tie and his medals. And I sang this and I put it on social media. And even though I was doing it, I was saying to myself, this is bonkers, this is crazy.
Well, sometimes you just don't have to post it. That's
yeah,
what
I know that,
but
that's what mania does for you. And I'll tell you the thing that really triggered the turn off for me, and it's why friendship's so important. Martin Sheehan used to work for me in number 10. He just phoned me up and he said, listen, Gaffer, he always calls me Gaffer, listen, Gaffer, do us a favour, turn your phone off. And that helped.
And the Scots Guards veterans.
Yeah, and the veterans associations weren't very happy. And Johnny Mercer, the defence minister, was raging about it. And Fiona wasn't very happy. So I knew I'd gone too far. I knew it was, but that was the end of the mania. And then the crash came.
How much of a difference does that new world make from when you were having your breakdown in the early 80s to being able to suddenly speak to hundreds of thousands of followers on Twitter in a second?
I don't know is the answer. I mean, might it have been easier to identify that I was cracking up if I'd been out there the whole time? I don't know.
Yeah, so look, it was obvious to people anyway. I phoned the guy Alistair was working for in the 80s, who was a very well-known Fleet Street figure at the time. And I said, look, I think he's having a nervous breakdown. And he basically made me feel like a sort of three-year-old idiot and brushed aside my concerns. And I just don't think that would happen now. I think any good employer would feel they were obliged to take seriously somebody raising those concerns. And I think that's progress.
Mm. Although there's still this huge financial divide, isn't there? I mean, one of the things that happened when my loved one died was I went to a mental health hospital to complain because in a week the person hadn't seen a consultant, whilst when they'd been transferred to a physical health hospital, they'd seen a consultant within minutes.
Oh, for sure.
And there was just nothing in the mental health hospital that would compare, even though the disease was just as serious. And I sat down in front of these doctors to say, look, what went wrong? And they said, you're a journalist. Can't you write about it? We just don't have enough money.
Yeah. I know exactly what you're saying about the services and those who are working in mental health. They're brilliant because the ones who are working in the mental health service and the National Health Service, they are virtually all under pressure, under-resourced and working too hard. But I don't trust this government to put this right, I'm afraid. And that's partly why I am saying there's an awful lot we can do for ourselves and for each other. I think employers are incredibly important in this.
Can I also just say there aren't many men who are kind of alpha masculine like you talking very openly about their mental health, because men have a serious problem with feeling they can't open up and resorting to more drastic things. Yeah. Obviously, resources are absolutely diabolical, but the one thing we can do is open up a sort of healthy conversation and make people feel safe talking about their mental health.
Do you think there are still misconceptions about depression?
Oh God, yeah, I definitely think so. But I think in the world of work, it probably is different now. And I think, you know, still a Republican, but I think the stuff the royal princes have done about the heads together and talking about it, and Prince William with those male footballers. I mean, I think it's out there in the mainstream media, 9 o'clock at night, you can turn on the TV and watch men talking about their mental health. And that would never have been the case in the 80s, where everybody had to be super successful and doing it all, not admitting to any vulnerability. And I think that's really a positive step forward. And we've still got a long way to go, because as you say, you could admit to having the problems, but you may not be able to get the services to help you. I mean, we've been very lucky, because we, in the end, you know, you were able to pay, weren't you? See a psychiatrist. But that is certainly not the case everywhere in this country.
We've talked about low points, but clearly you've had a lot of high points as well. And one of the things I've often observed in people who've got quite serious mental illness is a brilliance. You know, I talked about the person with bipolar. I thought they had a flair that was brighter than other people that I came across. And I wonder whether you felt that was the case with you, that with this terrible illness came a certain drive and motivation.
Oh, 100%. Absolutely. No doubt about that for me. I don't know if I always thought that, but I definitely think that looking back. Definitely. I think a lot of my resilience comes from my breakdown and my depression. I think a lot of Fiona's resilience comes from having got through it as well. I think that my creativity, insofar as I've got that, I think comes when I'm at the sort of 2-3 end of the scale. So yeah, I see it as being indivisible.
Grace, do you feel that about your own situation?
Definitely. A lot of the work drive that I have comes from my anxious part of my brain telling me that I'm never going to be good enough. And that sounds unhealthy, but it is true. It's what keeps me up at night. It makes me want to do better and really push myself in a quite extreme way. So I do definitely think that, but I just think it's all about balance and it's all about being able to know that work isn't everything. So like, you can be also brilliant in your social life and in your relationships. It's not all about work. And I'm glad I'm learning that at 26.
Just going to interject now so that I'm not as brilliant as them.
Yes, she is.
But I'm more, shut up, I'm more contented. And I've thought about that a lot. You know, why have I not soared to the sort of heights that Alistair did in a way? And I think that's partly because I haven't got that extra edge that comes from being a sort of manic person. And obviously very, very clever, but that urge to go further and overthink and go one step further than everybody else would do. You know, in the way that I think Alistair would, at some points, I've seen him so driven by, like in the run-up to the 97 election, for example, so driven by the thought of winning and the importance of that, that nothing else mattered. I could never be like that.
Well, I disagree with that, but...
You've talked during this interview, Alistair, about the psychiatrist who really helped you, David Sturgeon. Mm. And there's a story about a conversation with him in your book that feels like a good place to end this interview. Can you tell us about that?
Well, he's full of wise words. He does have a lot of kind of little truisms that he says. And I was very, very low. And I just said, David, look, you know, what is the point? When I feel like this, what is the point? And he said, the point of what? And I said, the point of life. What is the point of life? And he said, the point of life is to live it.
And so did you take his advice?
Well, I kind of do. I mean, at the time, I probably thought, oh, that's, you know. But it's true, isn't it? That is the point of life. The point of life is to live it.
Grace, Fiona, Alistair, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
That was Alistair Campbell, Fiona Miller and Grace Campbell. If you've been affected by any of the issues we discussed, you can contact the Samaritans on 116 123 or samaritans.org. Alistair has written about his experiences in his new book, Living Better, How I Learned to Survive Depression, published by John Murray. You can buy it at guardianbookshop.com. Grace also has a book coming out in October called Amazing Disgrace, about turning an overwhelming sense of shame into a defiant sense of self. Now, as the US presidential election looms, you can expect lots of coverage on Today in Focus, of course, but also every Friday, Guardian columnist Jonathan Friedland is hosting US Politics Weekly. Each week, he'll discuss the latest from the campaign with one of our reporters covering the race. This week, he's going to be joined by Sam Levine to try and get an answer to the question, when will we know who has won the US presidential election? So do make sure you listen to that. Just look for it in our usual Politics Weekly feed. That is it for today. Many thanks to Alistair, Fiona and Grace. This episode was produced by Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. I hope you have a lovely weekend and we'll be back on Monday.